This is Lecture 4 in the series Introduction to Pro-Capitalist Macroeconomics.
Well, good morning. The subject that I'm going to speak to you on today is the theory of wages. Last lecture, I explained why unemployment exists, despite the fact that the need for labor and the products of labor has no limit. Today, I want to explain what determines the standard of living of the average worker. A technical expression for this is real wages. Now, we had a distinction between monetary demand and real demand. Monetary demand meant the amount of money spent to buy goods or services. Real demand referred to the goods or services actually purchased. Well, this same distinction applies to wages. Wages, as we normally use the term, are money wages, the amount of money you're paid for performing labor. Often in economics, we refer to money wages as nominal wages. They are wages in name. Real wages refer to the actual goods that you can obtain for the money you earn. If you are earning $100 a week or $1,000 a week, taken in isolation, that fact really does not tell us anything. The actual meaning, the significance of the $100 or the $1,000 depends on the prices of the things you have to buy. It's perfectly possible in one context for a wage of $100 a week to be a higher real wage than a wage of $1,000 a week in a different context. If prices were more than 10 times higher, the real wage would be lower. The average Italian worker earns far more lira than the average American worker earns dollars, but his real wages are far lower. It would be very easy for the average American worker to earn the same number of dollars as the average Italian worker earns lira. All we would have to do is manufacture sufficient dollars. But in that process, the standard of living of the average worker, the goods and services he could actually buy for that wage, would almost certainly fall. His real wage would be lower, even though his nominal wage was higher. Now, in thinking of real wages, it is vitally necessary always to think not of wages alone, but of wages relative to prices. We always have to think of wages relative to prices anytime we think of real wages. So I ask you for a little while to keep that fact in the back of your mind, and we will get back to it and develop it at length very shortly. Now, practically everybody already has ideas about wages. All of you, I venture to say, walk into this auditorium with at least partly an economic theory. You do not call yourselves economists, and that's correct, but that doesn't stop you from having an economic theory. Everybody who talks about the content of economics walks around with an economic theory. Now, the economic theory that this audience has, I'm sure, is rather different than the economic theory on wages that most people have, but you may not know how to answer the other economic theory. Now, let me get down to concretes. The common economic theory on wages is that the capitalists have arbitrary power to set wages where they like. It's thought if we give the capitalists a free hand, their self-interest lies with paying lower and lower wages, the lowest wages they can imagine. A capitalist, like any buyer, the capitalist is a buyer of labor, any buyer would rather pay a lower price than a higher price. That's perfectly true. And it's thought, well, the capitalists would like to pay the lowest wages they possibly can. On the other side, the average worker is willing to work, if he had no alternative, for bare minimum subsistence. Rather than die of starvation, people are willing to work and work very, very hard. Now, the usual theory that people walk around with, their conceptual understanding of what determines wages is, on the one side, they see the self-interest of the capitalists. This is here, and this is where wages are to begin with, at this level. Here's the self-interest of the capitalists, which leads them to want to pay lower wages. The workers must work in order to survive. The only means of survival the average worker has is his labor. And rather than die of starvation, the average worker is willing to work for minimum subsistence. That's true. And people put these two facts together and they think that if the government were out of the picture, if there were no government interference in the labor market on behalf of the wage earners, if we didn't have government-sponsored labor unions, then, in effect, the self-interest of employers would be as a rock dropped into a vacuum tube. It would plunge, wages would be pushed down, and no point of resistance would be encountered short of minimum subsistence. The workers would rather die without working than die with working. So wages would not go below minimum subsistence. This is the usual thought. There is nothing in the market to halt the fall in wages short of minimum subsistence, at which point workers would take the attitude, well, if I'm going to die, I'll at least die under a tree rather than grinding away in a factory. Now, you may think, well, this idea is not so terribly influential, but it actually is. There are very, very few people who can be found today who would say that under capitalism, wages really are at subsistence or are anywhere close to subsistence. But think how many people believe that if minimum wage laws were repealed, if all of the legislation in support of labor unions were repealed, if the maximum hours laws were repealed, the child labor laws were repealed, what do they think would happen? Why do they think it's necessary to have this legislation? They think, take this legislation away, and we'll be right back with people working for subsistence 70, 80 hours a week. The children will be back in the mines, the whole bit. They think that the explanation of the low standard of living in the early 19th century was that at that time, the greed of the capitalists was unchecked. If you read a typical economic history book, or any history book insofar as it deals with economics, it is almost always simply taken for granted that conditions were bad because the capitalists were greedy SOBs and there was nothing to check the exercise of their self-interest. And now, why have things gotten better, let's say, since the 1890s? Almost everybody except the left wing of the ecology movement admits that things have gotten better since the 1890s. What's their explanation? Well, we have had growing labor and social legislation, and more of the employers have gone to Sunday school and to Harvard, so they're somewhat nicer guys. The explanation of the improved standard of living is that we've had allegedly enlightened labor and social legislation, and improved, that means more altruistic personal ethics on the part of employers. That's the standard explanation. Well, my goal today, and I don't know if it's, I'm sure I can't cover this today. I originally wrote this material as lecture 6. I was going to cover profit first. I stopped when this lecture got to be 82 pages long, so I'm giving it as 4, 5, and possibly also 6. Now, my goal at first is to attack the seeming plausibility of the notion that under economic freedom, wages go to subsistence. I want to rid you of any idea that this notion has any plausibility. That's my first assignment to myself. And then I want to start to present a different positive theory of wages, which I call the productivity theory of wages. The productivity theory of wages. The conclusion that I'm going to reach about what determines wages will turn out to be pretty widely held. You'll find many people say this, that real wages are determined by the productivity of labor, what the average worker is actually capable of producing per unit of time. But I think my way of showing this will be original. Then I'm going to look at the deeper causes of what determines the productivity of labor. I'm going to show that real wages, the general standard of living, depends on the productivity of labor. And I'm going to show that in the last analysis, the productivity of labor depends on the prevalence of two fundamental philosophical values, which are freedom and reason. I'm going to show how the productivity of labor through various intermediate steps, saving, competition, technological progress, whatever, all of these ultimately reduce to two simple fundamental philosophical values, freedom and reason. And then after I've established this positive theory of wages, we'll come back and reinterpret modern economic history in the way I believe it should be understood on the basis of a sound economic theory. And at the same time, we'll critique labor and social legislation. So that's my assignment to myself for today, tomorrow, and possibly Saturday too. Okay, let's start with the plausibility or the seeming plausibility of the notion that the capitalists can drive wages to subsistence. The workers need to work, they're willing, if necessary, to work for subsistence, and the capitalists want to pay less rather than more. All right, let's start with an analogous case. Two of them, in fact. Imagine that you have been living out here in Southern California and you own an automobile, let's say a fairly recent automobile in good condition, and now you have a job opportunity in Manhattan Island, in New York City. You've decided you're moving to Manhattan. And here you are, you've got this car. Well, if you know anything about driving conditions in Manhattan, you'll know that to have a car there, you'd either have to park it in a garage at a cost, now it may be $300 a month for all I know, or you'd have to spend several hours every other day driving around or waiting for a parking spot to open up. So let us assume that you just cannot afford to garage your car, nor are you able to spend the time driving around to find a parking space. How much would you be willing, if necessary, to sell your car for? I would say you'd be willing to give it away. I would say that if no one would take it from you, you'd be willing to call a salvage company and pay to have them take it away from you. All right, well, you're willing to do that. But now, let us consider, is your willingness to give your car away for free, if necessary, or pay to have it taken off your hands, is that actually relevant to the price that you can obtain for your car? Does your personal subjective willingness to give it away for free really determine what you can actually get? Not at all. You can get the going market price for the car, even though you'd be willing to pay to have it taken off your hands. And exactly the same principle would apply if you've been living in a large house and you own a grand piano and now you're moving into a small condominium. The same principle. There's a market value which is independent of your personal subjective preference, your personal willingness, I should say, to take it for nothing. Well, let's carry this a step further. Let's imagine that everyone in the country who owned a used car, who owns a car which he's going to sell, let's imagine that every single seller of a used car in the whole country was in the position of this individual who has the job he's going to take in Manhattan. So every single person who sells a car in the course of a year, we're going to assume, is willing to give it away for free if he has to. And I indicate that by this vertical SS line. What I'm showing here is, I'm assuming that, let us say, there are 2 million used cars sold in the course of a year. Well, this is 2 million. Here are 2 million cars. The owners of these 2 million cars, each of them, would be willing, if necessary, to accept the price of minus $50. That's what it would cost to call a tow truck. So everyone who sells a used car, I'm assuming, is willing to take a price of minus $50. Is that fact of any significance with regard to the determination of the price of used cars if all there are 2 million cars that are available for sale, and there are people around who would like to own used cars? Let us say there are potential buyers of used cars. There are people that we could find potentially buyers of 5 million used cars. There are 5 million people who'd like to acquire a used car at some price. Well, there are only 2 million used cars available. People would like, if we count up everyone who doesn't have a car or who wants a second car, the number of additional used cars that people would like to have is 5 million. But there are only 2 million available. Well, what is going to determine the price of these used cars? Is it the fact that the sellers are willing to take zero or a negative number? The price will be determined by the competition of the buyers. Whenever there is a good which exists in some definite limited supply, which the sellers may be willing to give away for free if necessary, the price is determined by the competition of the buyers. The willingness of the sellers to give the goods away for free is irrelevant. The need of the workers to accept to work, their willingness to work for as little as subsistence, is irrelevant. Nobody has to. Wages, think of the fact, labor is the most fundamentally useful and scarce thing in the economic system. I pointed this out in earlier lectures. Labor is used to make everything. If, in fact, there is no limit to our need and desire for goods, there's no limit to our need for labor. Labor is the fundamentally useful, scarce thing in the economic system. Its scarcity is deeper and more profound than that of used cars, grand pianos, whatever. So even if workers were willing to work for less than subsistence, even if they found their labor a pure joy and were willing to pay to be employed, that would be irrelevant to the wages they actually have to accept. Wages are determined by the competition of employers for something that is useful and scarce. Wages are determined, like the price of used cars, grand pianos, by the fact that each particular type of labor skill is useful and it's scarce. So the subjective willingness of the workers to work as low as subsistence or even less is actually irrelevant to the wages they in fact need to accept. Now, very closely related to this, let us look at the self-interest of employers. Now, it's taken for granted that the self-interest of an employer, like that of any buyer, is simply to pay less rather than more. Well, that is actually a half-truth. It's true that a buyer wants to pay less rather than more. But if we consider that carefully, it doesn't mean that it's truly to the self-interest of a buyer to attempt to pay the lowest price he can imagine. That is not to his self-interest. And in fact, let me give you a concrete example which I use in The Government Against the Economy, and I indicate its application to this context there, but let's work it out now. Suppose we have two individuals up here in the front row. Let us imagine that instead of my giving a lecture, I'm conducting an art auction. And this pad holder, this is a relic TJS pad holder from the second TJS conference, and it's up for auction, you know, like the ad on the Pepsi being auctioned and no one knows what Coke is any longer, if you've seen that one. All right, here we are. This is the valuable good which I'm putting up for auction. And there are two people in this audience who are interested in acquiring this good. We have Rose Walker up here, whom I know, and Robert Dunn, whom I know. And let us say that Mr. Dunn is willing and able to pay up to $1,000 for this wonderful vintage TJS pad holder. And Rose Walker is willing and able to pay up to $2,000. Now, Rose would much rather pay $200 than $2,000. Better still, she'd rather pay $20. Best of all, she'd like to get it for nothing. All right, well, what will happen if Rose walks in and arbitrarily refuses to bid more than, say, $200? Meanwhile, Bob is willing and able to go as high as $1,000. What's going to happen? She will lose. She will not get this pad holder. It will go to someone who, in fact, is willing and able to pay less than she. Now, if she truly wants this pad holder, what does her rational self-interest dictate? That she has to be willing to pay something over $1,000. Now, if we look at this concrete example, we can distill an abstract principle. The true principle of a buyer's self-interest is not to pay the lowest price he can imagine, but the lowest price which is simultaneously too high for any potential competitor who would otherwise obtain the good in his place. The true self-interest of a buyer is not to pay the lowest price he can imagine, but the lowest price that is simultaneously too high for any potential competitor who otherwise would obtain the good in his place. So Rose's true self-interest is to pay a price of, let's say, $1,001. That's her rational self-interest. If she tries to pay less than that, then she will not obtain the good which she wants and wants more than the going price. Well, labor is in exactly the same position. It's simply a difference in the number of units. Instead of one painting or one pad holder and two bidders, we have perhaps several million units of the same type and correspondingly a larger number of buyers and potential buyers. So we might have in the whole economic system, let's say, 100 million people seeking employment, but potentially the amount of labor which is useful, which could be employed in producing things that we would like to have, the number of full-time workers that we'd like to have the products from is several hundred million, many times more. It comes back to the whole discussion that we had in lectures one and two, I think. Just add up how many people you personally could employ as your own servants, and then think of how much income you could spend in buying goods and all the labor required to produce those goods in the current state of technology. So there is a scarcity of labor, and in a free market, wages are determined at a point. The true self-interest of employers is that wages be too high for other potential employers who would otherwise get the labor they want. The self-interest of employers is exactly the self-interest of Rose in bidding for the pad holder. They want a wage that is too high for other employers to get the labor they need. They want to pay the lowest wage they can that is simultaneously too high for other potential employers. Now, we can depict that in terms of this diagram. I have it in the lecture supplement. I don't know if I hope everyone has the lecture supplement. If you look at figure three is essentially this diagram on the board, only I call it wages on the vertical axis. And I've drawn a little horizontal line to show that the workers wouldn't be willing to work for less than subsistence. Here's minimum subsistence. Here's the supply of labor. All right. Now, in a free market, the employment of this number, SS, of workers would represent full employment, and the wage would be W. This would be the wage rate that would prevail in a free market. We'd have full employment. Now, in a free market, wages cannot go below the point of full employment. They cannot go below the point that corresponds to full employment. And in fact, this doesn't have to apply to the economy as a whole. It applies occupation by occupation, location by location. The wages of carpenters in Des Moines will tend to go no lower than corresponds to the point of full employment of carpenters in Des Moines. Now, what happens if the wage should be lower than corresponds to the point of full employment? Suppose wages, instead of being at W, were down here at X. Well, what happens to the quantity of labor that employers now can afford to employ? They can afford to employ more labor with the same funds. If wages are below what corresponds to the full employment point, the demand for labor, the quantity of workers demanded, the number of employees being sought, exceeds the number available. Now, here we have a wage down at X. There are employers who can afford to pay a wage of X, who can afford to hire extra workers at X that they couldn't afford to hire at W. There are employers who may not have been able to hire anybody at W who can now hire some people at X. To the extent that there are employers who are unable to employ labor, who otherwise couldn't employ labor, to the extent that some labor goes to these employers who couldn't pay the wage of W, what happens to the number of workers available for those employers who could pay the wage of W? There's that many less. If altogether, let's say, there are 100 million workers, and if wages are lower, now employers are offering 105 million jobs. Suppose 5 million workers work for employers who couldn't pay the market wage. 5 million workers are employed by employers who can only afford those 5 million workers because wages are lower. Well, what happens to the number of workers available for the employers who could have paid the higher wage and who could have had the 100 million workers? How many workers are available for those employers who could have paid the higher free market wage? They only have 95 million workers. They are willing and they want 100 million. They're willing and able to pay the 100 million. Those employers are in exactly the same position as Rose at the art auction. They, in effect, if they insist on bidding only X, then they are allowing other employers not able to pay more, not willing to pay more, to get the labor that they value more highly. If wages are below the point that corresponds to full employment, then that means there are employers able and willing to pay a higher wage who are letting labor go to employers not able and willing to pay as much as them. And that is against their rational self-interest. And whenever such a situation exists, the self-interest of these employers who need labor is to start raising wages. Now, you may wonder, well, when can we actually see this? When you can actually see it is whenever the government imposes wage controls. Wage controls hold wages below the point they would reach on a free market, and they create a shortage of labor. If the government is saying, we're only going to allow wages to rise 3 or 4% a year, pretty soon you get shortages of labor. There are employers who need workers, they can't find the workers, they can't hold their workers. In such situations, you'll find the employers actually conspiring with the workers to evade the law. They will start promoting people in a purely fictional way. They'll say, okay, we're giving you a higher title because if you have this higher title, now we're legally allowed to pay you the higher wage. They will start raising wages even when it represents violating the spirit of the law. It is truly against the self-interest of employers for wages to be below the point that corresponds to full employment. If there's unemployment, their self-interest lies with driving wages down. But once you hit the point of full employment, the self-interest of those employers able and willing to pay the higher wages is to push wages back up so that they don't lose their labor to others not able or willing to pay as much. So my conclusion from this is that not only is the need of the workers, their willingness to work for subsistence, irrelevant to what wages actually are, but so is the greed of the employers. The greed of the employers does not have the power to drive wages to subsistence. Wages go to the point of full employment in a free economy, and that's it. And then it's against the self-interest of employers for wages to go any lower. Well, now, the question could arise, this sounds reasonable enough, but mightn't it be possible that in the course of reaching full employment, if it's necessary for wages to fall to achieve full employment, mightn't it be necessary, not because of the greed or ill will of the employers, but just due to circumstances beyond anyone's control, that wages might have to go to the subsistence level just to achieve full employment? Because if there is unemployment, wages do have to fall to secure full employment. Well, I would say we should already know on the basis of discussion up to now that insofar as a fall in wages is required to achieve full employment, it does not mean a fall in real wages. Because if money wages fall and we now have more people employed, what happens to the physical volume of production? That goes up. And what has happened to the unit costs of production? That goes down. All right, what will happen to the supply of goods coming onto the market and the prices that it is necessary to charge in order to cover costs, either way you look at it? If we look at things from the point of view of more supply of goods, what has to happen to the price of goods? Price of goods drops, and if to the, insofar as prices rest on costs, prices drop. Now, we can, I think with good reason, we can generally assume that prices should fall pretty much in proportion to wages. Because suppose it's the case, let's say we had 10% unemployment. 9 workers in 10 are working, 1 in 10 is unemployed. Now, we're going to have a fall in wages. In order to achieve a fall in wages, if we have the same total payroll funds, what's required for 10 workers to work in place of 9 with the same total payroll funds? How much do wages have to fall on average per worker? One tenth. If wages are 9/10, then 10/9 the workers can be employed. If wages per worker are 9/10, then 10/9 the workers can be employed. Well, now, if the output per worker stays the same, suppose the each worker is able to produce just as much as before, only now we have 10 workers for every 9. What will happen to production? In what ratio should production go up? 10/9, right? If we have 10 workers producing where we used to have 9, now production should be in the ratio of 10/9. Well, if we have 10/9 the supply of goods coming to market, and we have the same spending to buy the goods, what should happen to prices? They should be 9/10. So what's the relation between prices and wages here? They're the same. Does this fall in money wages to secure full employment represent a fall in real wages? No, and in fact, as I showed, it would be accompanied by a rise in real wages because now you wouldn't have the burden of supporting the unemployed. The gross wages fall 10%, but your actual take-home wages fall less since you don't have to make a deduction for supporting the unemployed. So I go into this to make you realize that a fall in wages to achieve full employment does not, in fact, represent opening up the possibility of subsistence by the back door. Now, with all of this out of the way, I'm ready to go into the exposition of what I conceive to be a positive theory of the determination of real wages. What determines the average real wage in the economic system? And my answer is, what determines it in the first instance, this is not the final explanation, this is a critical step. The ultimate, bottom, deepest explanation will be the cultural values of reason and freedom, but I'm starting now at a much higher level, and my explanation is the productivity of labor. By the productivity of labor, I mean the output per unit of labor. How much does the average worker in the economic system produce? And this factor, I'm going to show, determines the relationship between wages and prices. The output per worker in the economic system determines the relationship between wages and prices, and thus real wages. And what I'm going to do is first function as an empiricist, looking at a number of concrete examples. Empiricism is really not the true word, because I'm constructing the examples we're looking at. But we'll look at specific concrete examples, and then we're going to see that again and again, in a wide variety of examples, the answer is the same. And then we're going to do a simple algebraic demonstration, a proof of the proposition. Well, here are these formulas, which I've repeated many times in the supplement, and which we've considered on previous occasions. And I want to run through a number of simple exercises which will show, in case after case, that what determines real wages is the productivity of labor, the output per worker. And we'll take as case one, which just the way I have it in the supplement, we'll start out, we'll assume the money supply in the economic system is constant. The monetary demands for labor and for goods are constant. In other words, total payrolls stay the same. Total spending to buy consumer goods are the same. We'll assume the total number of workers is the same. The only thing that we're going to look at that's different is the productivity of labor, the output per worker. Everything is the same except the productivity of labor, the output per worker. And I illustrate fixity by using an asterisk to show that the item is fixed. We'll just put a little asterisk next to it. So we have the same number of workers employed, the same total payrolls. The average money wage will therefore be the same. The spending to buy consumers' goods is the same. The one thing that changes is the output per worker. If we have the same total number of workers in the economy employed, but over a period of years, the average output per worker doubles. Let's say because we have the use of more and better machinery. All right, what happens to the total supply of consumer goods produced? What happens to the total supply of consumer goods produced? It should double. If the output per worker is the same, twice the with the same number of workers, two times the output per worker is equal to two times the output. Well, if we have the same spending to buy consumer goods, what happens to the general consumer price level? That's cut in half. The price of the average good would be halved if everything stays the same, except that the productivity of labor doubles. Well, what has happened to the average real wage in the sense of the ability of the average worker to purchase goods? That has doubled. If you continue to make the same money, but the prices which you pay are cut in half, your real wage has doubled. So observe, here we have as case one, a doubling of the productivity of labor and a doubling of real wages. Observe, it's achieved by way of a halving of prices. Any problem on this? I think this is pretty simple. All right, let's take as case two, we're going to forget about the doubling of productivity now, put that aside. What we're going to change now is the quantity of money and the volume of spending. We're going to assume that over a period of years, the quantity of money doubles. And this doubling of the quantity of money results in a doubling of demand for labor and demand for consumer goods. So we'll have double the money and double the monetary demands. All right, the demand for labor doubles. We're assuming still the same supply of labor. I spell it out what the assumptions are in case two. Money supply and thus monetary demands double. Population, working population, and productivity constant. All right, we have double the demand for labor. What happens to the average money wage? That doubles. The average person makes twice as much. We have double the spending for consumer goods to buy the same total supply of consumer goods. What happens to prices? They double. All right, wages have doubled and prices have doubled. What's happened to real wages? They are the same. Observe, the rise in money wages is not the source of the rise in real wages. What brings about a rise in money wages? The increase in the money supply. What raises the average money wage is the increase in the money supply. All right, let's make the analysis one step more complicated. Let's assume that over the same period of years, and this is case three, the money supply and productivity both double. The working population continues to remain the same. We're going to now have the same number of workers working. Their output per worker doubles, and at the same time, the money supply, and thus total payrolls and total consumer spending double. All right, here's double the demand for labor, same supply of labor. We have double the money wage. But now we have a doubled productivity. So with the same number of workers, each producing double, what happens to the supply of goods? That doubles. Well, if we have both double the demand for goods and double the supply, what happens to the general prices? They stay the same. All right, well now, if people's money wages double and prices stay the same, what's happened to their real wages? It's doubled. All right, but now let us look at what is essential. What is essential to the rise in real wages? Is it the rise in money wages? What is required for a rise in money wages to represent a rise in real wages? A higher productivity of labor. The way you can think of it is, here's more money in the economy. You can think of the extra money as a giant wave washing up on the beach. This wave, this larger wave of money, encounters the same supply of labor, so it doubles wages. But when it reaches the supply of goods, it happens that the supply of goods has doubled, so prices don't go up, prices stay the same. The relationship between wages and prices has changed in favor of wages. Wages have doubled because of more money, prices have stayed the same. But what is required so that when more money doubles wages, it won't double prices, but will leave prices the same? It's the rise in the productivity of labor. You see, just as I explained in connection with Say's law, that more supply was the necessary and sufficient condition of more real demand. Well, a higher productivity of labor is the necessary and actually the sufficient condition of higher real wages. If all we have is more monetary demand for labor and goods, there is no rise in real wages. Prices will go up just as much as wages. What's required for a rise in money wages to represent a rise in real wages is that at the same time, the productivity of labor has to go up so that the extra money which raises wages won't raise prices or won't raise them as much. The essential thing is the rise in the productivity of labor. We don't need money wages to go up. Real wages could go up without money wages going up. We could have the same money wages, real wages would go up, by virtue of the productivity of labor rising and prices falling. The critical thing is the productivity of labor. Now, cases 4, 5, 6, and 7 are really just further elaborations. Over time, at least in modern times, the number of people working will tend to increase. But we'll see that through any set of complications, the productivity of labor is still the critical factor. Now, in case 4, I say assume that everything is the same except the working population doubles. Money supply and productivity constant, population doubles. All right, let's say we have 2 times the number of workers employed. What would be required to employ them in terms of wages? We need half the average wage. All right, the money supply is constant, the demand for consumer goods is constant, but if we have twice the workers working and the same productivity of labor, what will happen to the output of goods? That'll double. What will happen to the price of consumer goods? That'll halve. All right, wages have halved and prices have halved. What's happened to real wages? They're the same. The productivity of labor is the same. Real wages are the same. Now, suppose we have case 5, money supply constant, productivity once again doubles, and population doubles. All right, we have double the supply of labor. So what happens to the average money wage? That continues to be halved. But the output per worker has doubled. What's happened to the supply of goods if we have twice the people each producing double? That's quadrupled. So we have 4 times the supply of goods. Well, now if we have the same spending for goods and 4 times the supply, what's happened to the price level? That's quartered. The price level would be 1/4. Well, what's happened to real wages if the average money wage has halved, but the price level has quartered? Real wages have doubled. If you're making half the money, but prices are 25%, real wages have doubled. What are real wages following? The productivity of labor. All right, well now, if we throw back in an increase in the money supply, suppose everything doubles. The money supply now doubles at the same time that the working population doubles and the productivity of labor doubles. Then what happens to the demand for labor? That'll double. We have double the demand for labor, double the supply of labor. What happens to the average money wage? It'll stay the same. We have double the demand for consumer goods. We have 4 times the supply of consumer goods, twice the people, each producing double. What happens to the price level? That's halved. All right, what's happened to real wages? They've still doubled. We could quadruple the money supply. If we quadruple the money supply, we quadruple the demand for labor and the demand for goods, what happens? What happens to money wages? They would double, and what would happen to the price level if we have quadrupled the demand for consumer goods and we have quadrupled the supply? They stay the same. So prices stay the same. Once again, we have double the wages and the same prices. But in each and every one of these cases, what are real wages following? The productivity of labor. All right, the productivity of labor is the essential, not the increase in the average money wage. Now, most people are actually unaware of this, and we'll see the consequences of their being unaware of it, especially when we get to look at the practices of labor unions and the way people think about things in general. But actually, the way the standard of living rises is by virtue of the rise in the productivity of labor. And the influence of the productivity of labor is always on the side of prices. Think about this for a moment. The rise in the productivity of labor does not act to raise money wages, with one exception. In what way can you think of the rise in the productivity of labor raising the general level of money wages? A shortage of what? Well, if you have the same number of people and the same spending to buy labor, that doesn't come up. I'm asking, how does a rise in the output per worker operate to raise the average amount of money that a worker receives? More gold. If and to the extent that the rise in the productivity of labor means a corresponding increase in the supply of a commodity money. If we have a monetary system in which gold or silver is money, if the rise in the productivity of labor means a doubling of the quantity of gold or silver money, then the average wage stated in gold or silver would go up. But suppose we have a rise in the productivity of labor in television sets, automobiles, housing, whatever, and for some reason, the supply of gold and silver just continue on as they were. In what way is the rise in the productivity of labor raising the average money wage? It's not raising the average money wage at all. It's raising real wages, but by way of reducing prices. Now, always, the rise in the productivity of labor operates on the side of the prices we pay, not the wages we earn. Because even with gold, suppose all we had was a doubling of the supply of gold. Suppose it turns out the next mission to the moon finds that 20% of the moon is gold and they start bringing it back in the shuttles. All right, even with gold, we might have prices calculated in gold doubling. What is required to stop the increase in money from raising prices just as much as wages and nullifying any possibility of a rise in real wages? There has to be the rise in the productivity of labor. Now, always, the rise in the productivity of labor is operating to make prices lower. If the quantity of money is increasing at the same time, the rise in the productivity of labor makes prices lower, not compared to what they were in the past, but compared to what they otherwise would have been if all that were happening was the increase in money. In those conditions in which simultaneously money doubles and productivity doubles, the influence of productivity is still by virtue of reducing prices. If all that happened was more money, prices would double. What allows there to be more money and prices unchanged is the doubling of productivity. The rise in productivity is always operating on the side of reducing prices, even in that context in which the effect is to lower prices in comparison with what they otherwise would have been. If all we had was a doubling of money, prices would double. If at the same time the productivity of labor doubles, prices stay the same. Well, if something stays the same instead of doubling, what allows prices to stay the same instead of double, by comparison, cuts them in half. The effect of the doubling of the productivity of labor, even when prices stay the same, is to lower prices. It's to lower them in comparison with what they otherwise would have been. Now, this is a really important point to keep in mind, I think, because what it actually means is the standard of living, the average standard of living, rises not by virtue of a rise in money income, but by virtue of a fall in prices. In reality, although it does not appear that way if you look at things superficially, on deeper analysis, the rise in the standard of living occurs by virtue of goods getting cheaper rather than our money wages rising. What makes the standard of living rise is an abundance of goods relative to labor. You see, think of the fact, what counts for real wages is the relationship between wages and prices. The only way the standard of living can ever rise is if, relatively, goods get cheaper relative to labor. Prices have to fall relative to wages. Even if both rise, the only way the average worker can get ahead is if prices rise less. They have to fall relative to wages. What makes prices fall relative to wages is if the supply of goods rises relative to the supply of labor. If we can step up the supply of goods relative to labor, if we can make goods more abundant relative to labor, what are we doing to prices relative to wages? We're lowering prices relative to wages. That's the essential factor. Making goods more abundant relative to labor, that's what makes prices lower relative to wages. And the way that goods become more abundant relative to labor, since they have to be produced, is by virtue of raising the productivity of labor. Now, I think I've established the principle empirically, but we can do it algebraically. And if you have the supplement, I would ask you just to take a few moments to go through it. The the average real wage is the money the average worker makes divided by the prices he has to pay. Now, to make that concrete, suppose the average worker makes $100 a week. Well, the significance of that 100 depends on the prices that he has to pay. If we could state the price level, if we could state the price of a unit of abstract wealth as $1, suppose we said the price of a unit of abstract wealth or abstract goods was $1, and the average worker makes $100 a week, then how many units can he buy? 100. All right? That's his real wage. It depends on the relationship between the 100 he makes and the dollar that he has to pay. All right, now we know that the money that he makes is equal to the total payrolls in the economy divided by the number of workers employed. The average wage is equal to demand for labor over the supply of labor. And the general consumer price level, we've stated many times, is the demand for consumer goods over the supply of consumer goods. Why is the price of the average unit of wealth $1? Well, let's say there's 1,000 units of wealth being produced, and there's 1,000 units of money being spent to buy them. That's why the price is $1. Why is the average wage 100? Well, perhaps there's 500 units being spent to pay wages, and there's 10 people employed. Or that would be 50. There's 5 people employed, 500 units to pay wages, and 5 people employed. So the average wage is 100. All right, well, all I'm doing is we have the average real wage in equation 1 is the average money wage over the general consumer price level. And we know how to state both the average money wage and the general consumer price level. They are separately stated in equations 2 and 3. And all I do in equation 4 is I substitute the formula for the average money wage and the formula for the general consumer price level back into equation 1. So we have, instead of the average money wage over the price level, we'll have the demand for labor over the supply of labor over the demand for goods over the supply of goods. And then whenever we're dividing by a fractional expression, we know that we need to invert and multiply. And then we know that when we're multiplying, it doesn't matter what order we multiply in. We can multiply 3 times 5 or 5 times 3. It's the same thing. And when we do that, we end up with equation 6. We have the average real wage is equal to the demand for labor, total payrolls, divided by the spending for consumer goods, times the supply of consumer goods over the supply of labor. Well, what does this expression, supply of consumers' goods over supply of labor, reflect? The productivity of labor. What equation 6 is doing is stating average real wages as the product of the productivity of labor, the relationship between the supply of goods to the supply of labor, times the demand for labor relative to the demand for consumer goods. All right, well, this expression, demand for labor relative to demand for consumer goods, that's total payrolls relative to consumer spending. If we have an economy in which there's 1,000 of total wages and there's 1,100 of consumer spending, that would be represented by this first term in the equation. Now you might ask, well, where does this other consumer spending over and above wages come from? Wages are the main source of consumer spending. What people are paid as wages is the far greater source of all consumer spending in the economy. What other sources are there? Interest payments, dividend payments, what partners and proprietors draw out of their enterprises. Well, the real wages are determined by the product of these two things. There's the productivity of labor reflected in the supply of goods relative to the supply of labor. The higher is the productivity of labor, the greater will be the supply of goods relative to the supply of labor. The lower will be prices relative to wages, whatever is happening to the quantity of money. And this other item, which for want of a better expression we can label a, quote, distribution factor, unquote, this reflects wages as a source of consumer spending relative to other sources of consumer spending. It's reflecting wages relative to dividend interest payments and the draw of funds by partners and proprietors. Yes, this first expression in equation 6, demand for labor over demand for consumer goods, reflects the ratio of total wage payments to other sources of consumer spending, such as interest payments, dividend payments, the draw of funds by partners and proprietors from their own enterprises. A partnership or a proprietor can take a certain amount of money out of his firm each week and he just consumes it on himself. So real wages depend on the product of these two things. How great are payrolls relative to total consumption, which indirectly means how great are payrolls relative to dividends, interest, etc., and the productivity of labor. All right, now, if we look a little bit deeper, if we want to ask at a deeper level what's determining real wages, we're going to have to ask, well, what determines the productivity of labor and what determines this distribution factor? What determines whether wages are going to be large relative to consumer spending or small relative to consumer spending? What determines whether the productivity of labor can rise more rapidly or stay the same or fall? Well, the next level of answer is what I call the economic degree of capitalism. The economic degree of capitalism, which I explain as the ratio of productive spending to sales revenue. And what do I mean by productive spending? I mean spending for the purpose of subsequently earning money. Productive spending is the spending that business firms undertake when they buy machinery, when they buy materials, and when they meet payrolls, when they buy anything for the purpose of subsequently selling their product. So productive spending is expenditure for the sake of making subsequent sales. You can think of it as synonymous with business spending. The higher is business spending relative to total sales revenue in the economy, the more the money that is spent to make money relative to the money taken in, the higher is the economic degree of capitalism. And that is the next level of determinant of real wages, because we'll see one aspect of this is it determines how great are payrolls relative to consumption. Let's suppose businessmen decide to provide more heavily for the future. They want to build up their firms. All right, a businessman has the option of taking the funds he presently has and consuming them. Or he could use those funds in his business. Let's say a businessman decides, instead of spending $25,000 on a trip around the world, he'll use those $25,000 in his business. And of the $25,000 he uses in his business, perhaps $10,000 will result in additional payrolls and $15,000 in additional purchase of materials or equipment. All right, productive spending is now $25,000 higher. But what about sales revenue in the entire economic system? He would have spent $25,000 on a trip around the world. That $25,000 we subtract from sales revenues. But what about the $15,000 that he spends for materials and equipment? What's the effect of that on sales revenues? That's $15,000 of sales revenues. The $10,000 that he pays as wages, what do the workers do with that? They'll spend it in buying something. So what's happened to total sales revenues? Total sales revenues are the same. What's happened to the ratio of productive spending to total sales revenues? That's higher. There's 25,000 more of productive spending. All right, well, one part of this is there's 10,000 more of wages. There's 10,000 more of wages, there's less of the businessman's personal consumption. His personal consumption is 25,000 less, there's 10,000 more of wages. What is implied about the ratio of wages to consumption in the whole economy insofar as this one act influences it? Wages are higher relative to total consumption. His consumption is less, wages are higher. What's implied about the ratio of spending for materials and equipment to spending for consumer goods? That's higher. Well, now, if you recall one of the opening points of Dr. Buechner about the what he referred to as the long-run rate of economic growth, or the natural rate of economic growth, but I would describe it just in terms of economic progress. We have a higher demand for materials and machinery relative to the demand for consumer goods. How will that affect the extent to which business firms produce materials and machinery relative to consumer goods? That'll be greater. Imagine General Motors has a passenger automobile division. They also have a diesel locomotive and heavy truck division. If the demand for passenger automobiles is down somewhat and the demand for diesel locomotives and trucks is up, how will that affect the way General Motors produces? It'll concentrate on the production of these capital goods. Well, now, to the extent that what I'm calling the economic degree of capitalism is higher, the economic system is going to concentrate more heavily on the production of machinery and materials relative to the production of consumer goods, and wages are going to be higher relative to such consumption as occurs. Consumption relative to capital goods is less, and wages relative to consumption is greater. Both of these raise real wages. If wages relative to consumption are higher, well, look at the effect of that in terms of equation 6. If wages relative to consumption are higher, real wages will be somewhat higher. If spending for capital goods relative to consumer goods is higher, and we concentrate more heavily on the production of capital goods, what happens to the amount of capital goods we'll have? We'll have more capital goods. What's the effect of having more capital goods on the productivity of labor? It's higher. Well, the productivity of labor will be higher, and the so-called wage share will be higher. Real wages are higher for two reasons in connection with the higher economic degree of capitalism. Now, I have to stress, the overwhelmingly more important factor is the productivity of labor. The wages, there's not much room. At best, there isn't much room for wages to rise relative to consumption. There's an upper theoretical limit of 100%. They're already perhaps 90% or 85% of consumption. That is not even potentially a significant source, and they've been at that level for generations. The source of higher real wages that has no fixed limit is the rise in the productivity of labor. It is potentially possible in future generations to double, triple, quintuple the productivity of labor, on and on. And over the last 200 years, the productivity of labor has been multiplied by an enormous factor. So that is by far the more important source. Now, this needs further elaboration. I won't attempt to do that now. I'll start off with elaborating the significance of the economic degree of capitalism and how it works itself out. That'll be where I'll start tomorrow. Let me stop now and at least have 15 minutes of questions. Thank you. The gentleman
is Mike. Yeah. I was wondering, is there any bad effect with the government pursuing a monetary policy designed to keep the consumer price level, in other words, to track monetary growth with production growth. Is there anything wrong with that? As I understand Austrian economics, that was a policy pursued in the 1920s, which contributed to the Great Depression.
All right, the gentleman asked the question, is there anything wrong with the government policy of attempting to have an increase in the money supply that would keep pace with the increase in production for the purpose of keeping the price level stable? All right, this is an idea which has had a large following over the years. Just create enough money to be sure the price level is stable. Well, the first point to realize is that such a policy is totally unnecessary. There's nothing required, there's no reason we need a stable price level. What we should desire is improving production and falling prices. Like, what do we want? A stable price of computers, pocket calculators? We benefit by the fact that they fall. The desire for a there's a fear of a falling price level. The main fear of a falling price level, I think, is its confusion. The source of the fear is its confusion with deflation. If prices fall because we have less money, less spending, then we have insolvencies and bankruptcies. But people don't make the distinction between falling prices due to less money or more production. They think they're equivalent, which is why I so strongly object to the use of the term deflation to mean falling prices or inflation to mean rising prices. Both have to be thought of in terms of the money supply. Now, if we realize there's no harm in falling prices due to more production, there's no actual necessity for such a policy. Such a policy implies that we could not have a gold standard if the gold standard implied falling prices. Suppose it happens that the supply of gold doesn't keep pace with the increase in the supply of goods in general. For long periods in our history, it didn't. In the whole generation preceding the discovery of the California gold fields, prices fell year by year because of improving production. And from 1873 to 1896, prices fell again because of improvements in production. Well, if we had the principle the government must keep the price level stable, that would mean the government has to set aside the gold standard to increase money more rapidly in those periods. Now, a further objection is the increase in the quantity of money never, you can't control it that directly. The government has the direct power to vary the increase in the quantity of money. That's the most that they can do. But the variations in the quantity of money do not directly and immediately impact on prices. So it's very easy for the government to have the problem. They're saying, well, look, prices are falling. Let us start increasing money to the point where prices are stable. And then they go ahead and they start increasing the quantity of money. But once they've done that, then the money gets out there, and then prices start rising more than they want. You know, it's sort of analogous. You're in the shower, and you want to get the water temperature right, and you're turning the hot water, and first it seems okay, and then you're scalded, and you may have been caught in that position a few times. Well, that's the nature of attempting to relate the increase in the money supply to the price level. They would always have this problem. So it would actually be destabilizing. Another question. Yes?
You said in your last lecture that unemployment is always caused by too high wage levels. But does that apply to a non-free economy? I think in a non-free economy, the government makes it possible to produce no matter how low wages were.
You say, in my first lecture, I said unemployment is always caused by too high a wage level. I said too high a wage level relative to the demand for labor. And now you say in a controlled economy, the government makes full employment impossible no matter what the wage level?
Yeah, that the government could make full employment, that the government could make full employment impossible by intervention into the economy.
The only way, if there is a free market in labor, the only way that the government could make full employment impossible would be if it were to go in and say, well, you can only employ so many workers. If it imposed direct restrictions on the number of workers employed. Or conceivably, if the government caused the productivity of labor to be so low, if they made conditions such that when you worked, you couldn't benefit at all from working, so that people wouldn't bother to look for jobs, they could stop full employment that way, but they could not stop full employment if they allow wages to settle freely. They otherwise couldn't stop full employment. Yeah?
I've read in this case stories about countries in the third world where the government has built modern factories, but then because of their borrowing, their excessive borrowing, they're unable to pay for the imported raw materials to the factories, so that the factories can produce, even if the wages of the factory workers are very low.
Okay, you're saying here in a particular case, we might have factories that cannot produce because they can't import raw materials. All right, but then we have to ask, what stops these workers from working elsewhere in the economy? Now, the problems of some of the very backward countries, I think a major part of their unemployment problem can be explained by the fact not so much that the jobs aren't available, there are jobs available, but the productivity of labor is so miserably low, and the willingness of the people to work is not overpowering. So I think many people who might be employed don't wish to be employed at the low level of wages that they would have to accept, the very low level of real wages. Yes?
Have you extended this analysis to make comparisons between labor-intensive versus capital-intensive industries?
It applies to the whole system. It doesn't matter what the degree of intensivity is.
I was thinking if the cost of material and capital were much higher than the cost of labor, that would give you one analysis, and if the cost of labor were the major component across the economy, it would give you
different. No, you see, let me make a point. Perhaps I should have gone into this earlier. I have been dealing on the assumption that all we're talking about is consumer spending and wages, which I've gotten away from that a little bit in the last minutes of this morning's discussion. This is a powerful simplifying assumption. If we start with the price of any consumer good, let's say automobiles, we can resolve the price of any good back into essentially just two things, profits and wages. And it doesn't matter whether it's capital intensive or non-capital intensive. Electric power production is highly capital intensive. Hand laundry is very labor intensive. But whichever, the price of each is equal to the seller's profit plus his costs. And his costs are equal to that part of his costs which are wages, and that part of his costs which represent payment to other firms. The part of the cost that's payment to other firms is equal to their profits and their costs. And their costs, again, are wages plus payments to still further firms. So every price is equal to just the sum of wages and profits. In the more capital-intensive industries, other things equal, we would find the profit share larger relative to the wage share. Let me give you a simple example of something highly capital-intensive, 30-year-old scotch. Now, suppose we paid a worker or a group of workers $100 to set up some newly fermenting alcohol in a barrel. And that's basically all we have to do, and very little checking and supervision, and we have to just wait 30 years. All right, and the rate of profit we'll assume is 10% a year. Well, 10% a year compounded means this $100 worth of scotch, when it's going to be ready for consumption 30 years later, will have grown in value by 1.1 to the 30th power. So it'll be several thousand dollars. The proportion of the price which is equal to profit is immense relative to the portion which is wages. If we had a product which would be ready in 1 month, the proportion of wages to the price would be 100 for wages, 1 to profit. So the degree of capital intensivity, I don't think, is really essential. Yes, so Mr. Kurtz.
Yes, I don't understand why there's a necessary connection between a fall in wages and a fall in prices. If I'm a businessman and my costs go down because my wages go down somewhat, this does not affect the demand that my consumers have for the product that I produce. I can keep my prices the same, and I can increase my profits simply by maintaining the same quantity of labor without increasing it and adding to my profits.
Okay, very good question. And Mr. Terzer's question is, why do I keep assuming that a fall in wages and costs will bring about a fall in prices? He can imagine a case in which he finds a way to cut his costs, but he'll keep his price the same and simply enlarge his profits. All right, now, this can happen in certain cases. Suppose you have a secret technology, or you're the only one producing this good, and it's also the case that you don't expect much additional business at a lower price. Now, if you thought you could reach a significantly wider market at a lower price, you'd lower your price even if you're the sole producer. But let's say you're not. Let's imagine that you're producing razor blades back in the days when Gillette was the only significant company, and Gillette finds a way to produce its razor blades at a lower cost, and they don't think that there's anyone not presently shaving who'll shave if they lower the price, so they don't lower the price. All right, now the question is, what do they do with the extra profits? You see, here they are, they produce the same quantity of blades at a lower expenditure of money. Now, where does the money go that they used to spend to produce the razor blades? If they continue to use these funds productively, if they continue to employ the same funds in some line of business, maybe not in the razor blades, maybe they use it to finance the startup of their underarm deodorant or whatever, or they put the money in a bank, or they buy into another firm, if it's the case that they are now continuing to use the funds no longer required in razor blade production for some productive purpose, what will happen to the supply of other goods? All right, there'll be a larger supply of other goods somewhere else in the economy. Now, if there's the same total spending in the economy, but there's a larger supply of goods, even though it's somewhere else, what happens to prices? Prices will go down, but in some other line. Now, if here we have, there's a higher rate of profit in this particular industry, and there's a somewhat lower rate of profit, a very tiny reduction because it's such a big mass elsewhere, well, what will people be trying to do? They'll be looking at this exceptional rate of profit in this line. So sooner or later, what is going to happen? There'll be competition, and then the price in that line will fall. But observe, any reduction in costs operates to bring about a reduction in prices, maybe not in exactly the same line, but somewhere. If the funds being released from the production of the particular product are used in production elsewhere. The only way that wouldn't happen would be if the reduction in funds required to produce this particular product were then taken out and consumed. You see, if the owners of business firms decided to step up their consumption and we had what I would refer to as a somewhat of a lessening of the economic degree of capitalism, then wages, or then the prices might not fall. But that's what would be required. But I don't think that that would happen. I think the extent to which saving and consumption go on are determined by people's basic value judgments. If we have people who earn higher profits, typically most of the extra profits will be plowed back. Yes?
We were working on the assumption that you showed that we double the productivity of labor, in effect, holding everything else constant, we double the average real wage.
Right.
Which means in your last formula, since the supply of consumer goods over the supply of labor is the productivity of labor, then when that doubles, the average real wage must double, which means that the other part of the formula must be equal to 1?
No, it just means that it's unchanged.
Oh, that's a constant. The demand for labor, the relationship to the demand for consumer goods is a constant.
If that relationship stays the same, you see, we're talking about a change now in real wages. All right, now, the demand for labor might be, let's say, 9/10 the demand for consumer goods. You could plug in the numbers,
9 for demand for labor, 10 for demand for consumer goods. And now, if we have double the productivity of labor, if the next term is 2, then whatever it was before on the left-hand side of the equation, it's now going to be double. See, it's not necessary that the expression be 1, just that it stay the same. This is the last question I'm going to be addicted to. Yeah.
When you were talking about the productive spending relative to sales revenue, you referred to wages as an example of productive spending, but I believe you referred to it as paying wages so that the workers will keep on working, rather than paying them for work already being done. Is there any significant difference there?
No. Okay, well, see you all tomorrow.